The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Well, we all know the cost of education has been going up every single year. Over long periods of time, the cost of education has exceeded the CPI in the cost of living. But it gets even more expensive when you're considering a private education or what we call the A schools. Is it really worth the extra $100,000 to $150,000? Joining us on the program as my special guest is Rob Franek. He's Senior Vice President and Publisher of the Princeton Review. Rob, I want to begin with, you know, what the numbers are today. I hear that a private education like Harvard or Stanford can cost as much with room and board as much as $60,000, $70,000 a year. A private four-year degree could run in the neighborhood of anywhere from over $200,000 to as much as $280,000. Can you bring us up to date? What does it cost to go to a top 10 school like a Harvard or Stanford, you know, MIT? What does that run today?
I'm totally hearing the question, and it's one that comes up often from students, you know, coming into our Princeton Review channel. The numbers that we talk about, and we call it, Jim, total cost of attendance. This is tuition, room and board, fees, and books. And the total cost of attendance for 1 year of private college or university, averaged nationally, is a little over $41,000. But you're very right. So many of the schools that our students and so many students and parents are considering now might top the $50,000, $55,000, $65,000, $68,000 NYU in my home city of New York City this year. So they become heart-stoppingly expensive. But I do want students and parents to take some minor solace, at least, to understand that $41,000 is the average cost of attendance for 1 year of private school. On the other side of the fence, total cost of attendance, again, tuition, room and board, fees, and books, for 1 year of public university, this year, about $19,400. So we still know that other than buying a family home, college tuition is going to be the second, and in some cases, the most major expense that a family will take on. The good news, though, is that more than two-thirds of all students that are college-bound and in college now are actually paying the sticker cost, that total cost of attendance. They're offsetting that with financial aid, and this is free money, you know, merit-based grant aid, certainly scholarship dollars that will bring those costs dramatically down, and then in some cases, students taking out loans.
When you're talking about right there, if we just stick with the average numbers, Rob, basically, let's just round it off and say $20,000 for, let's say, a state university, $40,000 for a private education. It's twice as expensive. So I guess the question that really comes up, because we're hearing all kinds of things like high unemployment rates with college graduates, is the extra money paying twice as much for the education? Is that return on investment worth the additional dollars?
The way we discuss it at Princeton Review is students have to be able, college-bound students have to be able to find a best-fit college or university. And the way we define it is certainly academic fit. You want to be challenged in the classroom. Campus culture fit and lots of things fit into that bucket of what you're going to be doing outside the classroom. But the last two issues of fit are a financial aid fit and a career services fit. And I think it's that last part of career services that I think clearly answers your question. We talk about this Princeton Review and say, listen, let's break some taboos here and start talking about what is going to be the return on your investment. If you decide to pay for a school that's $68,000 a year annually or a school that's $21,000 a year annually, what is the difference between school A and B? What are you getting for that difference in cost? And the truth is that it's not the same for every school. What we try to talk to students about is being smart during their college research when they are still in high school along with their parents and asking questions that were taboo just a few years ago, asking the question of ROI, asking the question of what the career service resources are that you're going to have access to, asking about alumni network and what that means for a current student, either through internships or jobs afterwards. So I do think that there are differences in schools. Even though those tuition costs are different, I think there are many differences in the services and the access that students can get because of the school that they're going to.
You You know, I was told, at least when I was going to college and graduate school, I was told by my professor, one of the advantages of going to like an A school like a Harvard or a Stanford, you go to Harvard, you're going to be around people that you may later on in life have alumni that become the next Supreme Court Justice, the President of the United States, or the CEO of a major corporation. So networking with those kind of people is another advantage of those A schools.
I just so appreciate that guidance. And in many ways, it is true in that if you're going to an Ivy League school or a school with a big brand, you will have a great brand and a great network of alum to access, honestly, for the rest of your adult life. And that is a very powerful lever. The thing that we've been talking about at Princeton Review is that it doesn't stop with Ivies. I have a new book that came out, and I'm one of the authors for it called Colleges That Pay You Back, and it came out in February. One of the ranking lists that we do, and there's substantive narrative in the book, and it's all available up on PrincetonReview.com, which is our website, but we do seven different ranking lists in that book, one of which is Best Alumni Network. And just number four in that list, Claremont McKenna College, which is part of the five Claremont colleges out in Pomona, California. Exceptional school, but only 1,800 students. But you can know also, you could take solace that, you know, a school like Claremont McKenna, which is an exceptional school, one of my personal favorites at Princeton Review, can still be a powerhouse school with a small student body with a powerful alumni network. So I caution students, or I challenge students and parents to think beyond brand and perceptual brand reputation and say that there's going to be best fits for you that can also be great ROI for you later on in life.
So two of the things that you look at when you're evaluating a college, it's not only career opportunities, but also the ability to offset those costs with financial aid. Now, you recently did a study on a number of colleges, and I think you boiled it down to among the 200 best colleges out there. And what were some of the criteria, and how did a school qualify to make it to your top list?
Well, I'm so appreciate you asking the question. And the end result of that book that I had referenced called Colleges That Pay You Back, and we started with just over 2,000 four-year colleges and universities to start in that universe of schools. And then we whittled down that list to the final 200 that are in the book. They are divided near evenly between public and private universities as well. Specifically for the criteria in the book, we looked at basically three different buckets. We looked at what is that total cost of attendance? So what is the sticker cost, as we talked about before? Second bucket is how aggressively is that school making that school affordable for students? So what types of grants and scholarships are they giving out, not forcing a student to take out a loan? And then the third part is that bucket that we're just talking about. What are the career resources that are going to help me, not when I'm a second semester senior, but a first semester freshman? And this is such a powerful thing. And I'm curious to see if this was your experience when you're in school, but I didn't know about the Career Resource Center when I was a freshman or sophomore, or probably even a junior in college. I found out about it when I knew how to get a job later on. But schools are so gloriously different now, or so many are so gloriously different, in that you are being introduced to the career resources, not even when you're a first semester freshman, but when you're a prospective student. And that changes the conversation. That changes the conversation for a student looking for a school and a parent helping them along the way with their guidance counselors, because now you can talk about ROI and you can talk about internships and co-ops and experiential learning and jobs afterwards or graduate school afterwards, but you can talk about that when you're still choosing what school is going to be the best fit for you.
You know, I know there's a lot of different forms of aid, and perhaps, Rob, you can address this. I know there's scholarships, there's merit, there's various low-financed aid packages, but there's also work programs. So you work at the college and offset some of those costs.
The easiest way to understand financial aid, and it is a bear of a process, but when I talk to students and parents, I tell students, listen, and these are high school students, your job is to be awesome in high school. Your job is to do superlatively on the SAT and the ACT. That is your job, because those are going to do two things for you. One, hopefully secure you admission to the many schools that are making it onto your list that you're actually applying to. And number two, it can qualify students for scholarship dollars from those schools. Basically, academic merit-based scholarships, money you do not have to pay back because of your performance in high school and on standardized tests. When I talk to parents in those same audiences, I tell them their job is singular, and that is to be fearless around the financial aid process. And coupling those two things together, hopefully we're creating very confident college shoppers, because the financial aid process, I mean, we call it financial aid, but it is, as you say, both a mixture of scholarships scholarships, grants, merit-based money they don't have to pay back, and then some loans, some work-study programs, and things like that. The biggest thing that a student can remember, and a parent, is that other than their college applications being the primary of importance next year or the next couple of years, the financial aid application, and there's an acronym that it stands for, FAFSA, which is the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. That is the grail for college financial aid applications, and it will qualify students and parents to get that aid. There are some additional financial aid forms for a certain number of schools, one's called a CSS profile, but the primary driver is going to be that FAFSA form, and that will qualify students for need-based aid based on family need. It will also qualify them for loans based on the things that you were talking about, work-study programs, other than the Stafford loans and things like that that a student might want to take out or work for part of their college tuition. The biggest bucket that students can help pull on is a 40% bucket, and that 40% bucket doesn't come from the aid from the FAFSA form based on need. The 40% bucket will come based on their academic performance and performance on SAT and ACT. I can't underscore this point enough, because students have an active job in this process, and that is to be great in school and to do well on standardized tests, because it qualifies them for academic admission and scholarship dollars for the majority of the 4,000 schools out there.
Rob, let me ask you, and I don't know how applicable this is to a private college, but a lot of in-state schools will take students from, let's say, a junior college. So you go to a junior college here in California, it might cost you $2,500 a year. You take, you know, all your undergraduate required courses like English 101 and 102 and basic general courses, and then transfer to, let's say, a state school. Now, you know, that's what I did because I had to work my way through college. I went to a junior college. It's hard to believe I paid $45 a semester, so I don't want to give away my age. Yeah, but when I transferred to Arizona State, when I was going to a junior college, I got in touch with a counselor that told me these are the courses that will transfer to Arizona State. But when I graduated with Arizona State, my degree said Arizona State. It didn't say one half Arizona State. Does that same thing apply to like an A school, like a Harvard or a Stanford, or do they only take beginning students from freshman year on?
That path to a four-year degree, to a bachelor's degree, absolutely is viable for students today. Starting at an associate's degree granting school, a two-year college, junior college, you know, associate's degree school, call what you will, and then moving on to a four-year school. You can certainly transfer in to any school in the country, including the most superlative, the most broad, the most academically challenging to get into. The problem is that so many students want to go to those schools as well, both as a first-time freshman as well as for a transfer student. So I'm reluctant to say that there's a, let's say, a backdoor way for a student to get into some of the most competitive schools in the country by being a transfer student. It is certainly a viable route for students, but the population is small that goes in as a transfer student. But there are schools like Arizona State University, of which I am a big fan of both Michael Crow, their current president, as well as many other large state schools and smaller privates as well, that welcome in transfer students. Because the truth is that there are always going to be students that are churning through the process. Some will move on to an additional school and we will fill their spots, you know, just through, you know, natural course of doing business. Students may, you know, transfer out of a school. So there'll always be a needed population coming in as a transfer student. And, as you cite, there is great value to that from a student from a pocketbook wallet perspective, and that is a fine, fine route. The only detractor, well, there are two quick detractors. Sometimes an associate's degree granting community school is not right for every student. So I go back to what we were talking about before. Students have to be able to sensibly say, this is a best fit school for me, and to make that decision without hesitation. The other part, transferring into a four-year college, is that generally speaking, the scholarships that you'll get for those last 2 years of time will be far less than a student would get as a first-time freshman, simply because you're going to be spending 2 years there instead of 4 years. But, you know, you can still make a dramatic savings, as you were saying, for those first 2 years at a community school or two-year granting school, whatever it might be, and make up that savings later on.
So when you take a look at bringing down the cost, I think you said almost two-thirds of college students receive some form of financial aid, because even state schools today, when you're talking about $20,000 for a room, book, tuition, all of that can add up. And if, you know, you're a parent and you have two or three kids, you're talking about a sizable amount of money over a period of time. You came up with the top 20 colleges that pay you back, meaning that the money you're going to spend for the degree is well worth it when it comes to career choices and, let's say, opportunities after college. What was your selection process? How did you get onto that list?
That list is a subsidiary list from the 200 schools that made it into that same book. That's the same name as the ranking list. So the colleges that pay you back, we have 200 schools that, again, are all superlative and doing great work, certainly providing an academic environment that's highly competitive, but then also providing students with great financial aid and then, you know, career services upon exit, or even when they're in school, but jobs upon exit. We culled out the top 50 most superlative out of that 200 list, and those are the schools that made it into the book. So the criteria is the same. It's those three buckets: one, exceptional academic experience; two, exceptional financial aid experience; and then three, exceptional career services, resources for undergraduates, and then once they graduate as well. The one other thing that we looked at and that we factored into all of those schools is looking at pay scale data. So where did students go after they graduated from college? And we followed, we partnered with payscale.com that does a lot of tracking of, you know, of students, of people as they're moving through their professional lives and finding out what disciplines they're in or what jobs they're in, what their academic discipline was as an undergraduate, did that, and did that propel them into the career that they are now? You know, what is their starting salary? Where are they now in their salary history? So trying to think about that longitudinal view was essential coming up with that 50. Number one on the list this year is Caltech. I mean, average starting salaries for a Caltech student, probably not surprisingly, is, you know, are some of the highest in the country, well over $75,000, you know, for students coming in. And then Princeton, Cooper Union, again, here in New York where I am, Cooper Union for the Advancement of Sciences, Harvey Mudd, one of the other Pomonas that we talked about, number five on the list, not surprisingly, is MIT.
I see some of the A schools there, too. You're talking about Princeton, you're talking about MIT, Stanford, Yale, Brown, Columbia, Vanderbilt, although Amherst, University of Pennsylvania, Dartmouth, Duke, Cornell. So the A list makes up a good sizable portion of that top 20.
You're very right for pointing it out. There are those schools that are going to be A-list schools, some usual suspect schools that have great brand reputation. I mean, I underscore that these schools are not only great perceptual brand, but they are paying students back when we start to talk about, you know, college ROI. I do still love that we are extending that lens of schools, looking at the universe of schools, and then saying, you know what, Carleton College in, you know, Northfield, Minnesota also deserves great mention on that list. It's number 28 on the list of 50. You know, WashU and St. Louis, UCLA, Sportsbook, Pomona. I mean, these are all exceptional schools that should be in that same conversation as a Caltech or a Princeton.
Yeah, because you also had a list. You wrote an article called 13 Public Colleges with the Best ROI. And so let's talk about some of the list of public schools, because, you know, for most parents, that seems more affordable. Obviously, going to a public college could be a lot cheaper than going to Stanford or Harvard.
It will be, and it can be for some students. But when I talk to students and parents, one of the biggest mistakes that we've seen students and parents make, college-bound students and parents, at the Princeton Review, is crossing an expensive school off of their list of consideration early on just because of that sticker price. So if a school is charging, you know, let's look at Rice, you know, they're about $58,000 or $60,000 a year, but their average aid package for a student is well over $43,000 this year. So bringing that cost down to what we had talked about in the beginning part of our conversation, which was, you know, what is the average cost to attend 1 year of public university, which is just around $20,000 a year. So there are schools that might charge a high sticker price. Some of those same schools will have the deepest pockets financially, and they will say, okay, you know, Jim, you've demonstrated that you have financial need. I have financial need. They're going to meet our need, in some cases, 100%. And Rice is one of those schools that can say that. Princeton is another that can say, listen, we're going to meet a student and family's demonstrated need from the FAFSA form 100%. And that is something that most state schools, although lower in tuition costs, likely won't be able to do. So my challenge for students and parents is to communicate, to be as smart and savvy as possible around the selection of schools and being armed with financial aid data and the scholarship data, the average scholarship that students can get as they're making their decision of where they're going to apply and ultimately enroll.
I know there has been a movement. In fact, it was in the press this week that there is some movement by Congress to have some of these A-rated schools like Harvard, Yale, Princeton use some of their endowment funds to lower the cost of education or face possible taxation. Now, that was brought up this week in the Wall Street Journal. Is that a possibility? In other words, could you see that happening? And let's say to thwart such attempts by Congress, could you see more aggressive financial aid packages coming from these large schools?
It would be difficult for me to say that I'm going to see a credible rollback of tuition costs for the many, many schools that we write about. I do think that more and more schools are saying, you know, our costs are so high and we are causing such worry and stress in the college process for students and parents because of the specter of paying for college and the specter of having so much debt upon graduation and being underemployed upon graduation. What I do think that we'll see is the latter part of what you were saying, which is probably more dollars going towards financial aid. So if we're saying 2/3 of students are receiving some sort of financial aid for school, I wouldn't be surprised if those numbers and those percentages continue to tick up rather than a rollback of dollars in raw sticker costs.
I tell you, Rob, it's been really delightful to find a service like yours, because this is a question that, you know, I, in doing financial planning with a lot of my clients who have the means and some not as much, they talk about, what do you do when you have a bright student, but there's three kids in the family, you know, mom and dad just simply can't afford $250,000 at an A school for all three children. I mean, that's almost like a luxury home here in California. If you were to boil it down, let's say you were counseling parents who have a bright student graduating, what would be the steps in the process in pursuing an education? To me, it seems like it's very important to look at what the job prospects are, because you don't want to pursue a degree where there's no prospects for any employment once you get out. That would be important in addition to the cost. But take our listeners through this step. If you were advising or counseling a parent and a student, what steps and how would you begin?
Number one, for students that are gifted academically and that we know can survive in some of the best schools in the country, and if they have multiple kids at home and they're just nervous about paying for college, my first bit of advice would be to never curtail the list of consideration early on. So we should sail through looking at many different schools, not looking at sticker cost at first. We must think about fit, academic, campus culture. Those things are going to be what students and parents need to focus on. I can see myself in this community, whether it's, you know, Claremont McKenna or Vassar or Brigham Young University. Let's look to see where we're going to be happy and engaged in the classroom, and we're going to be, you know, excel in that community. But then thinking, and I do agree with you, the next step is thinking about what's going to happen to me as a student. What are the outside of the classroom opportunities that I can get that are going to be directly related to my academic work and a career afterwards? And that can be formal internship programs, cooperative experiences. The buzzword over the last couple of years has been experiential learning, the idea of learning by doing, but something that's tethered to what you're learning in the classroom that has an outside of the classroom experience, usually in your home city or hometown. And those things make for, and I can use Northeastern University as an example, they have a full year co-op program up there. You know, their students graduate, although in 5 years, as some of the, because they're doing this one co-op outside of the classroom for an entire year of study or year of experiential work, they become some of the most employable upon graduation because of that initiative. My second point is for students and parents to be vigilant in asking about what's going to happen to me through a career resource lens, through that experiential lens. And then third, what are the real financial aid metrics? I mean, we have this, my job at Princeton Review, one of our hats here, is to think about what the real cost of college is going to be. What is the average grant that I'm going to get, the free money that I don't have to pay back? What is the average loan debt that students are going to graduate with in 4 years after this school? I have that data. I've done that homework, you know, and that homework is for students and parents listening to us to access. I mean, it's here. And those are the three buckets that I would focus on.
As we close, Rob, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do at Princeton Review and also the book that you published on the 200 best colleges, how could they do so, please?
definitely our website is the most inclusive place to go, which is PrincetonReview.com. And then the book that we've been talking about called Colleges That Pay You Back, certainly available on the website, any major bookstore or online bookseller. But the website has the lion's share of everything that we talked to today, from testing to admission to financial aid.
Well, listen, Rob, I want to thank you for coming on the program. It's really nice to see organizations like yours, because I think, you know, this is a big question. As you mentioned, you get asked, and I get asked when doing planning with my clients for their children's education. Hey, you know, what's the cost of college? What kind of aid packages are out there? What are the prospects for jobs? Is it really worth the extra, you know, paying twice as much for that private education in terms of the benefits after you get out of college? And you guys have gone a long way to answer a lot of those questions. Rob, once again, thanks for joining us on the program.
I thank you so much, Jim. Thanks for inviting me. I hope to be back soon.
Yeah, no, it's sort of interesting. I do miss the academic environment, Jim. It's really interesting because I spent almost 12 years in college myself, and I'd love to go back into philosophy classes and just wreak havoc because, you know, philosophy or political classes, because I don't need a grade. Yeah, we do that. But when you look at the top 20, you know, the A schools, you still got Harvard and Stanford and MIT in those. But what's really good to know is you can get a good quality education at the B schools as well.
Yeah, I mean, they do have a list of top 13, some of those B schools. And it's surprising because, you know, obviously the education is much, much cheaper. Everything from Georgia Institute of Technology and several schools, like I know for business, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And then here in California, you have UCLA, you have UC Santa Barbara, UC Berkeley. So there are a lot of those B schools, public schools, that are right up there as well. And of course, depending on your profession, as we discussed in the case study today, it just didn't make a lot of sense for somebody that was going to become a teacher at $40,000 a year to spend $200,000 for an education. Anyway, that concludes this week's program. We're going to be doing a few more programs on education, hopefully help you, the parent, or you, the student listening, find that right college and that right program, and hopefully get a good college education with a job waiting for you when you graduate. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.